Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, the Maine Audio Information and Reading Service, a program of the IRIS Network, serving Maine's blind and visually impaired. My name is Cynthia Bowman, and I'm reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife. This is the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. Our last episode featured musicals and operas, the culture available when moored in a big city harbor, Boston in this case. Dorothea contrasts her complaining tightwad mother-in-law with her generous father-in-law, whom she loves. Those two don't seem to spend much time together. Off again, Captain Fred and his wife go, bound for Puerto Rico and the cargo waiting there for transport. The total lack of a breeze has sent both the ship and Dorothea into the doldrums. Perhaps we can move them on their way in this next episode. May 17, 1912. Anchored in the stream at Maranabo to load, arrived Sunday and shifted twice when soundings told us there was enough water nearer land where the little tugs with their barges won't have such a long trip to make. Lunched with Don Jorge at the Finca Bordales, and a most attractive little spot it is. Jorge said he should not have let me marry El Godo. All Anglo-Saxons are to him what the Goths were to his Iberian ancestors, who have transmitted down through the ages a dislike for the crude barbarians who upset the Romano-Hispanic civilization of the 5th century. That's a long memory. His brown eyes and laissez-faire attitude may once have been charming to me, but I thank God for devilish Fred, Maine, and all the other goodies I'd have missed by being a signora. Still, it's fun to be wooed when you're 30 and pregnant. I told Miss H., and she was round-eyed with Bostonian shock. How she'll do as a newspaper hen is beyond me, but she does enjoy the lecon asado, the yucca, the plantains, and the avocados, bless her little bean-fed tummy. That was not nice, Dorothea. Miss H. has been very sweet and helpful. Hasn't she been a joy helping with the embroidery on baby's clothes? I do hope I haven't let her influence the design of the clothes, though. All 5 slips could be spotted from afar as being of Bostonian patterns, because they are so distressingly plain. From my gay Latin background, I've been tempted to add a few bright colors and a curlicue or two. How Don Jorge did compliment me on the yellow shawl I wore with my blue gown for lunch at the Finca. Fred would have said I looked like an old squaw, one of the gaily plumed seabirds he loves to shoot, the birds that must have been named for the chattering and loud vocals of Penobscot Indian women. Miss H. hopes with me that this little baby will be good and healthy and grow up to be straight and useful. If it's a boy, I want him to be strong like his papa, manly and noble. If it's a little girl, please God make her dear and sweet and darling. And, oh, how I do wish it would be one of each, and that both live. Dora, Dora, my girl, you must never, never reread or review what you have written. In that paragraph about the seabirds, you contumely condemned, by implication, your husband, whom you then proceeded to eulogize as the model for your baby. In one place you love him, in the other you hate him. But that may be realism, my dear. After all, aren't old squaws tasty? You'd better settle down, my dear, say in that little house at Herring Gut, where the long winter will poke some sense into you and deliver you from soaring from the heights of happiness to the depths of despair, all in 1 minute. Maine can be sobering. And I do agree to having our own little home on land in delightful Port Clyde during these coming months, about 4 now, while I gather strength. Port Clyde is such a busy place, I know I shan't be bored. It has ships visiting every day, and the factories provide action, and I shall steal a piece of land from Fred to start a town library where the books I furnish can be read all winter by others as well as me, so that we may discuss them. We'll get the blood of the Puritan descendants back on the intellectual route. Will it be possible? I know some of them want it. Will the fundamentalists cooperate or censor? How many varieties of illnesses can a pregnant woman have? Or is it the diet aboard ship, the salt horse, salt mackerel, rock-hard biscuits, molasses cookies, and doughnuts without eggs? Yet I must be bright and pleasant for my husband's sake, even though my tummy feels like a rock, rolling rocks all bumping into each other. May 29th, 1912. Puerto Rico, all around it and through it. It is many a long day, some dreary and some sparkling, since I have written in here. But today I must write for relief. Perhaps if I explode here, I may be able to handle things more competently on this ship. Miss Henderson has sailed north with her impressions and her notes. God knows what the Boston Herald will print of us. Being typically Bostonian, she did not show her thoughts, and the newspaper write-up could be praiseworthy or condemnatory, but, knowing her, I suppose it will be factual and not at all sensational. I do hope so. She spent 3 lovely days with us at Arroyo on shore, and 1 day in Ponce and 1 as Miss Verge's guest at Aguirre. There we went by auto for a delightful lunch with red-checked tablecloths, just like Boston's waterfront restaurants, which made Miss H. feel she had never left home. We called on Mrs. Chisholm to get all the gossip. Miss Verge's brother came from Humacao to see us and had thousands of questions about his native friendship and his brother Enos, the great sailor who navigates by the feel of the sea and wind. Miss Watts, she of the Thomaston tribe, spent a day and a night on board with us, a slight, dainty little lady like a pale pink tea-rose, a fragile piece of Haviland china. Fred honors her great-uncle, Captain Sam Watts, for whom a big square rigger was named, but shies away from the little lady who would probably do a backward somersault if Fred opened his mouth with his usual crudities. But I'm not fair. He can be so damned honey-tongued that it fairly sends me into gales of laughter, knowing what he is thinking while the goo oozes. Yesterday I taught Spanish to several New England ladies who have just arrived for their husbands' stints at Aguirre. Also made fudge for Fred and Captains Rodding and Wallace, who were visiting us and spent the day sailing ships while moored to the land. Both of their vessels are waiting for the Hopkins to finish loading. We are 4 sailing vessels and 1 steamer at anchor here. When the trades don't blow, it is fun to wake in the morning as head ship of the anchored flotilla, and, when the wind starts up, suddenly find we're the last ship in the fleet, all our ships turning with the wind or tide, which is slight. It's also fun to hear the false dawn crowing of the roosters from land answering their brethren in the coops atop the houses of the anchored ships. No need for translators. Tasted oysters plucked from the palm trees lining the channel. Very good, and such a relief after the supper last night of salt beef and fried potatoes, and a breakfast of cornmeal and salt mackerel. Such a beautiful diet for a pregnant woman. Oh, these Easterners, especially those down-Easters! Such selfish, niggardly tightwads! Fred refused to take me on shore for a decent meal, and then, while I ached so nothing but a back rub would console me, he snored, had to massage myself, and then damned if he didn't roll over in his sleep and grab me in those powerful arms to hold me. I couldn't move, and finally had to knee him to get out of bed and seek some sleep in the hammock. I ought to have mutinied back in Jayville that first trip, when he made me have the abortion, and I might yet do it. and then the day before yesterday when he lied to me. I knew he was equal to several different kinds of deviltry, but I did not know that he would lie to me directly. I asked him if he was going ashore, and he said no. Then, in a few moments, he took the launch and went, leaving me behind, and disappeared around the island looking for fish. Thank God it was only fish he was hunting. Then the devil returned with a grin and several letters to me, one from Miss Foote of Jayville. So exasperating! How I wish I were strong-minded enough to ignore that handsome grin and keep silent for a solid week, not talking to him at all. Then he would beg for conversation. A good dinner on shore, and afterwards an awful pain. So many pains lately. I don't care about myself, my eating and my feelings, so much as I do care about the child. I must take care of myself. I shall see to it that I am properly treated. Fred has simply got to walk the chalk line, or else. Friday, June 7th, 1912. Letters today. So Aunt Sue has known ever since that awful episode in Jayville. Editor's note. Aunt Sue Kingman of the Brewster family was a distant relative of Dorothea Moulton, with whom Dorothea stayed in Minneapolis while attending the university. That awful foot girl cannot keep her lips closed at all. But if Aunt Sue knew, why didn't she come on to Boston to see me? The Lord knows she has plenty of money, what with being chief heir to the Pillsbury monies. She writes that she has one of those new electric autos. I must get west to see her and take a ride. Spent Wednesday and the night at Rio Blanco, Mr. Preston's country hacienda and finca. An 11-course dinner. Wow, how Fred does manage to make up for the salt mackerel. Cool and pleasant in the heavy rains as we watched while dining from the veranda, and such a lovely big bed after our bunk, and no rolling of the ship. At first I missed the roll and could not sleep without it. My first evening on land since last September. Delicious grapefruit, and how charmingly our hosts did act and talk. Wow! It made me cry later at what I've been missing, but then I guess pregnant women cry at almost anything. And think of what they have been missing. They may scintillate in their conversation, but who of them has walked barefoot in the rainforests of Tijuca or toured incognito the red lights of Rio? I finally understood Fred's unwillingness to talk. He has seen too much and knows too much for landlubbers. They would never understand. And I'm caught right in the middle. I love good conversation, and yet I must be careful about talking of things I've seen. I don't want to be known as another George Sand, and Fred despises having people classify him as a La Munchausen. So he confines his conversation to Ea, and It might be, and Yes, I was there, while I say, Is that so? And Very interesting, which, used in a Spanish conversation, muy interesante, means how dull. Seafarers are a distinct tribe, my girl, and now you're one, so take it for what it's worth, and glory in its attributes. As Fred says about the old Greek fruit peddler, who summed up life quite well with, What I make on the bananas, I lose on the potatoes. You can't have it all. So take the cash and let the credit go, my dear, as Omar said, nor heed the beatings of a distant drum. Damn the drums, I'll take ship's bells. June 17th, 1912. Picnic on the island yesterday. I took the launch and by myself ferried the three American girls out for a swim. They were quite impressed with my boat handling, but I wasn't. Should not have beached her on that damned coral, but on the beach of white sand in the little cove where we swam. One of them, Eva Boyden, will sail north with us. We picked up pink and white coral for souvenirs. Inside the reefs, where I thought we'd all be safe from sharks and barracudas, I swam face to face with the barracuda. First saw him staring at me about 6 feet ahead. I remembered what Fred had said about not making the slightest move. I froze. He stared. I stared back, underwater and holding my breath. It seemed I would pop. He moved sidewise. I stayed still. When it seemed my lungs would burst or I would have a miscarriage from the pressure on my tummy, he sidled off seaward before I moved a muscle. What a relief to see the big-mouthed monster's tail! They can take a leg off as easily as swatting a fly, what with their inward slanted teeth. Of course I said nothing about it to the girls, but once on the beach I lay down for quite some time until my pulse rate fell below 1,000 a minute. Whew! Was to go uptown yesterday to see about that awful baggy new dress, but guess I shall have to wait another day or so, because the stevedores are enjoying a strike, and that foolish man of mine is having all sorts of conniption fits and spasms. Went to town after all, and enjoyed it. May sail tomorrow. Visited Captain Sargent of the Bull Line steamer Ruth, named for one of the Sugar Central wives. Had strawberries on board, and enjoyed the clean and well-varnished cabin of the captain. I wonder whether Mrs. Kent will like the steamer Peter Crowell, named for Captain Crowell, Mr. Thurlow's partner from Cape Cod. The lovely, big, and roomy cabin of the Governor Powers would suit me better than the tiny quarters, no matter how well varnished, of the Ruth. Captain Sargent says the Peter Crowell is not big enough for the Panama trade for which she was built, should be twice as large. I hope and believe he's wrong. Fred has put money in the Crowell, and she was built to go into ports where big steamers can't go when loaded deep. Would I prefer a steamer? The captain's quarters are up so high. Ours are below, and cool. They have refrigerators and cold storage, however, and quick trips compared to a schooner. But I do so love my little Hopkins. And it was in her that we did our courting and took our seagoing honeymoon and spent our first year of married life. Here we have been as happy as two, such as us, have a right to be. June 9, 1912, at sea, homeward bound. Reading those parts of my diary that precede the Utuado entries, describing my indecision and decision to sail north as chaperone for Betty, I've plenty of time for once because Eva Boyden, with the constitution of an ox, makes the daily fudge, cleans the cabin, sews on baby's garments, bulldozes Fred, and is such a dear. What a holiday for little me! I've taught her to take the sights, and now she won't even compromise on the day's run with Fred, but commands him to use her position instead of his, and then comes to laugh and joke with me about how he stutters when she shows him where he added instead of subtracted. Dawsey is laughing, too. With me, of course, not with Fred, and Dawsey says we should sign Missy Boyden on forever. She'd at more of a skipper than anybody I see but my granny, says Dawsey. From my 1908-1910 diaries, I know now that I was a vacuum in search of what I finally found. Imagine making entries about tea at Aunt Sue's and about Cousin Harrison telling her of his petunias, and my decision to chuck the charity job Aunt Sue got for me and move on to the teaching job in Puerto Rico. Wasn't that wonderful? And I was so doubtful. Aunt Sue thought I was going to the ends of the earth. Mama cried, and Papa threatened to take me back on the farm, where the only men I'd have seen would have been Norwegian farmers who think they're funny, calling alfalfa Alfie Alfie. God preserved me, and the fat, stinking Sioux Indian squaws hogging the coach seats on the train run from Minneapolis to Dawson, and the insipidness of the Chautauquas. I wrote that I was glad to get east of Chicago, and I was. Niagara was a thrill to me then, but now it's a small waterfall compared to Brazil's enormous Iguazu. Back then, I hadn't a clue that the Sioux of Iguazu, just as the word Niagara, showed a connection with the Altaic language of northern Asia, proof enough to me that the American Indians came from that area. Niagara is like the Turkish Ne Akar, where there is water, and Sioux, as in Iguazu, Missouri, and other river names, comes from the word for water, Sioux, found also in Japanese. Tipi is from Tepe, Turkish for tent. Allegheny means, in that lingo, the red hills. Eskimo is Eski, Turkish for old, combined with Mo, Mongol. Then when I sailed down the Hudson, I did not know why I felt so good, but now I know, from my Maine experience, that I felt like a salmon, an alewife, or a smelt, heading for my natural habitat, the open sea. New York was dirty, but I loved every one of its theaters and museums, and I adore the Westminster Hotel, which is French in patrons, English in waiters, and cheap in price. Saw the tipsy Flatiron Building, was shocked at land being worth $20,000 per square foot along Fifth Avenue, or so said the rubberneck bus announcer in his horrible Brooklyn accent, past Vanderbilt's white marble palace and two of Gould's, who couldn't stand not being more showy than the V's. The Astors, too, have a white marble home, while the Rockefellers were inclined to the red for their Baptist church, and had a gray stone house to be different, and show that they were not unchristianly gaudy. Riverside Drive, above impressive Grant's tomb, was more tasteful. The roof of my hickish mouth must have gotten sunburned back then from gaping at the sights. And Tiffany's, lawsy mercy, honey child, how you did gawk! It must have been then that I decided that one day I would have a joyous array of candlesticks and Tiffany glass vases. And thanks to my wondrous Fred, I'm well on the way. We can afford some luxuries because Fred is such a successful shipmaster. While others hesitate, he acts. That's why the Hopkins pays dividends, while other vessels require shareholders to pay reverse dividends to make up for the deficits and contribute toward keeping the vessel maintained and ready. If only Fred would go ashore and manage the fleet, they'd all pay like the Hopkins. But he won't. He loves too much to sail her. And that's certainly all right with me, so long as he entrusts the management to smart old Mr. Thurlow, we'll be all right, especially with Fred putting money into steamers. My diary tells me that while in New York I saw John Mason at Little White Hackett's in The Witching Hour. It seems eons ago, after the Metropolitan Museum enchanted me with the Corots, Turners, and Borghams, I finally looked at my watch and had to rush back to the hotel, grab my suitcase, catch the subway on the run, and get to the SS Como bound for Puerto Rico, just as they were taking in the gangway. There's a note in my log that I sighed with relief at leaving, but I must get back to little old New York again, now that I have the beginnings of appreciation. 80 U.S. teachers on board bound down to teach the Puerto Ricans English. Weren't we fools to think we could make them over into our own images? And wasn't the Department of the Interior misguided to try it? What a shame it would have been had we been successful. That wonderful culture destroyed. Shades of the Penobscot Indians. Apparently, I discovered Puerto Rico on September 23, 1908, just a few centuries after Ponce de Leon was ordered to his namesake Ponce for assignment. The last night on board the Como, we all gathered aft, following our baked bean supper and the ship's music, and we sang into the night until, after a short sleep in deck chairs, we sighted Morro Castle and steamed in past an Argentine ship, which had been quarantined for months with Yellow Jack. Little did I know about such things. Was impressed by the ox carts along the road to Ponce, the narrow streets, the lack of yards in front of the horses, and the pastel greens, blues, oranges, pinks, and yellows of the houses, things I hardly notice now. At Ponce went to the Hotel Inglaterra, where was met by Mr. Terry, the school superintendent, a fine man from Boston. He told me that breakfast for Puerto Ricans was only café con leche, but that the waiters, knowing I was una gringa, would serve me with fruit and an egg. Imagine being so naive that it showed on my face. Or was he telling that to all the girls? How I was impressed with the Spanish wooing and the red uniform of the bomberos, the firemen of Ponce. Oh, to live that innocent series of surprises once again. And milking the cows into a bottle, then boiling it. I'd never heard of such things. And the way you learn Spanish so quickly, not out of a crashing intellectual effort, I'm sorry to say, but out of a devilish ability at mimicry. Oh, it was a heavenly 2 years. But am I ever glad Freddy Boy happened by? I shall have to do more often this research into my past, but not now. New England and childbirth are coming up on the horizon, and I must start my packing. That's all we have time for in this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading the log of the skipper's wife, the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano.